Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 596, update on September 11th and related matters. This program is being recorded on May 6th of the year 2007. Well, once again, hello, and let's plunge right in. And on side one, we concluded by taking a look at a frivolously and a falsely optimistic article from Time Magazine, or an op-ed column from Time Magazine. Really, in Time Magazine, that's sometimes not the easiest distinction to make. But anyway, this was in June of 2001, and the article was saying, oh, ha, 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 the notion that Osama bin Laden is sitting in his bat cave commanding a worldwide legion of terrorists is just ridiculous, blah, 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 blah. That article turned out, I think, to be falsely optimistic, in the sense that Osama bin Laden is not a lone nut, as he's been portrayed, or part of a group of lone nuts, as he's been portrayed. There is at least a wisp of credibility, at least a wisp of truth in that article. But basically, that article is ignoring the reality, not only of Osama bin Laden. If his name was Osama bin Rockefeller, people might have an easier time locating bin Laden as what he is, which is the scion of one of the world's most powerful and wealthy families. In turn, the events of September 11th are the outgrowth of the operations of a consummately powerful global network, a fascist global network, one with very strong connections to the corridors of overt and covert political and economic power, and one with many, many overt criminal activities. Inside one, we took a fair amount of time taking a look at the murder of the coach of the Pakistani cricket team, allegedly, according to an article from the ESPN website, done in retaliation to an upset victory and the consequent loss by Islamist-connected gambling elements, also gambling elements connected not only to Islamists but to the Pakistani intelligence service. They lost money, apparently, on that match, money that they'd hoped to finance future activities. One of the things that we're going to be taking a look at in side two not only concerns more different aspects of this global network, we're going to take a look at some of the other criminal activities, and we're also going to take a look at yet another, in my opinion anyway, falsely optimistic prediction concerning the powerful political and economic forces that were behind September 11th. In the very first of the AFA shows, back from April of 1984, we took a look at how the American media, and also the worldwide media, painted a very rosy picture of not only the Third Reich, but fascist Italy. People ranging from Hermann Goering to Joachim von Ribbentrop, the Nazi foreign minister, to Mussolini himself, were in a position to write op-ed columns for some of the Western media, assuring everyone of their benevolent and peaceful intentions. This due to the fact, basically, that some very, very powerful corporate and financial elements were allied with the fascist powers of Europe and Asia. The Bush family were one of those, the families that helped to support fascism. And just as the powerful corporate links to the European fascism of the World War II period led to an overly benevolent and far less critical portrayal of fascism in the Western media, so too the very powerful economic and political links between powerful corporate elements in this country and connections in the Middle East are also leading to what, in my opinion, is a dangerously inaccurate characterization of the Muslim Brotherhood as benevolent. I would strongly encourage members of the listening audience to contact Spitfire, get a hold of AFA programs 1 and 2, take a look at that benign media portrayal of international fascism in the World War II period, and compare it with what we're seeing today. on the Spitfire website, one of the many resources that people can take advantage of is Miscellaneous Archive Show M42, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini, and the Mythology of the Corporate State. That Miscellaneous Archive Show from February of 1990 compared the economy of the U.S. under Reagan and Bush to, that's Bush 1, by the way, George Herbert Walker Bush, the father of the current seated president of the United States, and Mussolini's fascist government of Italy. Utilizing the books Can These Things Be? From 1931 and Sawdust Caesar from 1935, both books by George Seldes, the broadcast takes a look at what the reality was of Mussolini's corporate state as opposed to the way that the American media portrayed it. I would suggest, too, that because there are some big bucks to be made courtesy of the petroleum industry, some big bucks to be made courtesy not only of the oil money itself, but the reinvested capital on the corporate landscape, because of those economic ties, the reality of the Muslim Brotherhood is being portrayed in a very, very benign way indeed. So please use the Spitfire website. Check out Uncle Sam and Il Duce. Find out what they were saying about corporate fascism the last time out, and then utilize some of the other archive shows, such as For the Record 455. Take a look at the new Muslim Brotherhood. Looks suspiciously like the old fascisti of Italy. From the MSNBC.com Newsweek website, a puff piece by Stephen Glain from Newsweek International from April 30th of 2007, Mideast, the new Muslim Brotherhood. Don't look now, but the face of radical Islam has changed dramatically across the Middle East. Zaki Bani Arshad is the Muslim Brotherhood's new man in Amman. The General Secretary of the Islamic Action Front, the Brotherhood's Jordanian chapter, might be expected to spout the rhetoric of his predecessors, heavy on Quranic injunctions and talk of a pan-Arabic Islamic caliphate. So what's all this about democracy? Our minimum demand, he says, from his business-like offices in downtown Amman, is for freedom of expression and assembly, real elections with multiple parties, rule of law, an independent judiciary, and a free press, unquote. This isn't your father's Muslim Brotherhood. It's still the world's oldest and largest Islamic movement, but as with Arshad himself, these days it's gone heavy on populism and light on God. Known as the Ikhwan in Arabic, renowned for its conservative and often backward ways, it now counts women as members. Once wary of engaging in the parochial rough and tumble of politics, it increasingly collaborates with non-Muslim and even secular groups pushing for democratic reform. That big tent, unquote, political pragmatism is now helping the Brotherhood move decisively into the Arab mainstream, scoring big election advances from Morocco to Egypt to Lebanon as the champion of the little man, concerned with such daily life issues as health care, the price of cooking oil, and good, clean government. By the way, parenthetically, that's how fascism always portrays itself. We are looking to take care of the little man, the little rods in our large bundle, the foscus of state, so to speak. Continuing. Washington seems to be taking note. I bet they took note the first time around. Continuing, Washington seems to be taking note. Earlier this month, a delegation of U.S. congressmen met a group of Egyptian lawmakers that included a senior Ikhwan leader once at the Egyptian parliament and again after dinner at the U.S. ambassador's residence. Quote, "The Brotherhood has become more moderate as it matures," unquote, says Adnan Abu Odeh, a Palestinian activist in Amman. "The new generation cares more about power than God," unquote. The transformation is evident at the polls. In Bahrain, following elections in 2002, the Brotherhood captured 17.5% of the legislature. In Libya, the Ikhwan has become the largest opposition party, though it maintains a low profile to avoid the capricious wrath of secular strongman Muammar Gaddafi. In Egypt, the Ikhwan won 88 out of 454 legislative seats in a December 2005 election, marred by government fraud and intimidation, making it the largest opposition party there, too. So fearful is the Egyptian regime of the Brotherhood's influence, in fact, that it recently amended the constitution to ban political parties based on religion. The Brotherhood is expected to win a significant plurality, if not a majority, of parliamentary seats in Jordan's national elections this fall. It's also expected to win the largest number of votes in Morocco's upcoming parliamentary vote. If it once was the very epitome of radical Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood today draws its growing strength from precisely the opposite, its perceived balance between the ideological extremes of Al-Qaeda and the administration of George W. Bush. Their cosmic struggle of good versus evil is of scant concern to most Muslims, and the Brotherhood knows it. Ask an ordinary Arab what it stands for, and the likely response would be affordable health care, schools, and vocational training. Far from constituting a dangerous underground, the Muslim Brotherhood increasingly draws its core constituency from the ranks of law-abiding professional elites, pious doctors, lawyers, engineers, and educators alienated equally by U.S. policies and Al-Qaeda's violent intolerance. Does Muslim Brotherhood want to be the ruling party? Asks Mohammed Mahdi Akef, the supreme guide of the Ikhwan's Egyptian chapter. Yes, but only through the ballot box, unquote. In contrast to the region's corrupt and lethargic governments, the Muslim Brotherhood is respected for delivering on an impressive array of social programs, especially for the poor and disenfranchised. It finances a sewage treatment plant in the slums of Cairo. In Jordan, it runs one of Amman's largest hospitals, offering free medical services to those who might not otherwise receive health care. In Lebanon and the Palestinian territories, it runs schools and job programs. The Ikhwan has not forsworn its former political agenda, to be sure. In Jordan and elsewhere, for example, it advocates an Islamic justice system. And certainly, Middle East regimes have cause to be concerned. They are increasingly afraid, says a Western diplomat in Cairo, not merely because the Brotherhood might come to power, but because it might rule more honestly and effectively than those currently in office. But from the point of view of the Arab man on the street, would that be so bad? Unquote. Reminds me again of the way Italian fascism was soft-pedaled in the run-up to World War II. AFA goes into that. Miscellaneous archive show M42 goes into that in a big way. And once again, note that, as I mentioned in, among other shows, for the record, 560 and 561, just as there were the most profound connections between big capital in the West and the big capital of Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, and imperial Japan, so too there are the most profound connections between people involved with financing terrorism, people involved with financing Islamism and the Muslim Brotherhood, and powerful corporate interests involved with media, involved with banking, involved with various manufacturing corporations, as well as, obviously, with the petroleum industry, because of those very same mainstream corporate connections. Because the corporatist economic philosophy of fascist Italy is basically reflected in the corporatist economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood, so that institution is seen as a vehicle for corporatism and globalization, not only in the Islamic world, but elsewhere as well. And as for the benign assurances of the Muslim Brotherhood that it stands for moderation, well, the slaughter now going on in the Sudan is a direct outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood government from the late 80s and early 90s that not only sponsored Osama bin Laden, but launched the current landscape of horrors that is embracing and engulfing the Sudan. Reviewing very quickly an article from For the Record Program 560 about the Muslim Brotherhood and its corporatist philosophy, bear in mind when you hear the World Bank's encomium for the Muslim Brotherhood here. The World Bank is now headed up by Citizen Wolfowitz. His Saudi girlfriend, basically, or his Muslim girlfriend of Saudi education and socialization, has been very much in the news recently. What hasn't been in the news recently is the fact that Grover Norquist, Mr. Let's Privatize Everything in the Whole World, including both halves of your very own rear end, Norquist, Grover Norquist not only married a Palestinian Muslim woman, but when queried by a conservative colleague about whether he had converted to Islam, said, quote, "That's too personal a question," unquote. Was that a between-the-lines clandestine yes? I don't think that's much of a stretch. It remains to be seen just what's going on with Grover, Let's Privatize Everything in the World, including both halves of your very own rear end, Norquist, himself deeply involved with and the lobbyist for Islamist terrorists such as Abdurrahman Al-Amoudi, Sami Al-Aryan, and others. Following article is also from Newsweek MSNBC. It is from July 3rd through 10th of 2006, Islam in Office. It's by Stephen Glane. And consider this against the background of the corporatist economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood as set forth in, for the record, 455. Quote, Judeo-Christian scripture offers little economic instruction. The book of Deuteronomy, for example, is loaded with edicts on how the faithful should pray, eat, bequeath, keep the holy festivals, and treat slaves and spouses, but it is silent on trade and commerce. In Matthew, when Christ admonishes his followers to give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, he is effectively conceding fiscal and monetary authority to pagan Rome. Islam is different. The prophet Muhammad, himself a trader, preached merchant honor, the only regulation that the borderless Levantine market knew. In Muslim liturgy, the deals cut in the souk become a metaphor for the contract between God and the faithful, and the business model Muhammad prescribed, according to Muslim scholars and economists, is very much in the laissez-faire tradition later embraced by the West. Prices were to be set by God alone, anticipating by more than a millennium Adam Smith's reference to the invisible hand, unquote, of market-based pricing. Merchants were not to cut deals outside the souk, an early attempt to thwart insider trading. Today, with a spiritual revival sweeping much of the Muslim world and with the Bush administration still keen on democratizing the region, it is worth asking how an Islamist movement would manage the economy. Since 2001, Islamist parties have made strong showings or won elections in 10 Arab countries, Morocco, Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Bahrain, Egypt, Kuwait, and Pakistan, and the Palestinian Authority. And none are clashing with the West on the subject of free market economics. In Iraq, the supply-side economic reform plan submitted in 2003 by former U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer has survived with only minor revisions under Baghdad's new Shia-dominated government. Yeah, and the blueprint for that, by the way, was drawn up by none other than the aforementioned Grover, let's privatize everything in the whole wide world, including both halves of your very own rear end, Norquist, about whom we've already spoken. Continuing. An interesting test came in the January election in Egypt when the Muslim Brotherhood, the fountainhead of modern Islamism, took a fifth of the seats in parliament. Now the largest opposition party, much of the Brotherhood's appeal rests on its network of hospitals, schools, and charities, which are often superior to state services and help the religious one. Fortunately for the reform-minded Prime Minister Ahmed Nazif, the Brotherhood's economic agenda is largely consistent with his own, albeit with a more populist twist. The Brotherhood embraces free trade ideals in general, but criticizes the government for failing to negotiate better terms for Egyptians. Though Islam tends to frown on tax collection, the Brotherhood supports tax reform, not abolition, and opposes a proposed flat tax as regressive. It even endorsed the recent decision to lift budget-busting food and fuel subsidies, but wants to use Egypt's ample natural gas reserves to finance a less painful transition to market prices. It must be done gently, says Mohammed Habib, the Brotherhood's first deputy chairman, with the objective of reducing the gap between rich and poor. In the 1950s, as the Brotherhood gained political momentum, it opposed President Gamal Abdel Nasser as much for his decision to nationalize the Egyptian economy as for his fierce secularism. Mohammed, says Yasser Abdo, a Muslim Brotherhood member and a former economist at the International Islamic Bank for Investment and Development in Cairo, believed in the private sector as the basis of productive activity, unquote, with a limited state role. Continuing, today Brotherhood parliamentarians remain anti-statist and staunchly anti-trust, citing a verse in the Quran, "He who brings commodities to the market is good, but he who practices monopolies is evil," unquote. Not that any member goes as far as questioning the OPEC. As Cairo University economist Abdel Hamid Abu Zaid puts it, "Islam promotes competition of a cooperative nature," unquote, not the cutthroat, unquote, Western kind. Politically, at least, the objective of fundamentalist Islam is to restore the Islamic Caliphate, the unified Muslim kingdom of the 7th to the early 20th centuries that stretched from the Hindu Kush to the Strait of Gibraltar. This rhetoric turns more practical on the subject of trade. If the ancient caliphate can revive itself, unquote, says Habib, who has a U.S. doctorate in geology, it will happen through regional commerce, unquote. A brotherhood in power, he says Habib, would respect Cairo's free trade agreements, though the group appears to be divided over whether it would honor one with Israel. In the days of the caliphate, Islam developed the most sophisticated monetary system the world had yet known. Today, some economists cite Islamic banking as further evidence of an intrinsic Islamic pragmatism. Though still guided by a Quranic ban on riba or interest, Islamic banking has adapted to the needs of a booming oil region for liquidity. In recent years, some 500 Islamic banks and investment firms holding $2 trillion in assets have emerged in the Gulf states, with more in Islamic communities of the West. British Chancellor of the Exchequer Gordon Brown wants to make London a global center for Islamic finance and elicits no howl of protest from fundamentalists. How Islamists might run a central bank is more problematic. Scholars said they would manipulate currency reserves, not interest rates. The Muslim Brotherhood hails 14th century philosopher Ibn Khaldun as its economic guide. Anticipating supply-side economics, Khaldun argued that cutting taxes raises production and tax revenues, and that state control should be limited to providing water, fire, and free grazing land, the utilities of the ancient world. The World Bank has called Ibn Khaldun the first advocate of privatization. His founding influence is a sign of moderation. If Islamists in power ever do clash with the West, it won't be over commerce. Well, amen to that. By the way, I would take a look at the new democratic, unquote, Muslim Brotherhood, very much like the way the Alianza Nazionale of Gianfranco Fini was remade in order to become a coalition partner of Silvio Berlusconi, and yet another member of that coalition partner was Pino Rauti, whose Ordine Nuovo terrorist group basically hailed straight back to the Mussolini period and the Salò Republic set up by the SS at the end of World War II. And note that Gianfranco Fini, the post-fascist, as he liked to bill himself, was very much part of the P2 milieu and the milieu of, quote, reformed, unquote, democratic, unquote, Italian fascism, but also through the milieu of the bank Altaqua, Per Felice Barchi, people like Gustavo Selva, Karim Alessandro Gay, very much linked to the milieu of the Muslim Brotherhood of Youssef Nada, and the elements, the benign elements that you just heard about. So again, the many faces of the Muslim Brotherhood network. Very quickly, an FBI agent has disappeared in Iran. This is a fellow named Robert Levinson, and his disappearance is being linked with his association with a guy named Saud Dalahuddin, formerly David Belfield. Taking a look at the following story from the Financial Times of Friday, April 13th of 2007, we find the following. An American fugitive living in Iran since he murdered an Iranian opposition activist in the U.S. in 1980 has revealed that he met a former Federal Bureau of Investigation agent shortly before the latter disappeared on the Iranian island of Kish a month ago. U.S. authorities have been anxiously seeking information about the former agent, Robert Levinson, for several weeks. The Iranian Foreign Ministry says it is trying to clarify his whereabouts. U.S. officials suspect he is in Iranian detention. European diplomats in Washington hesitate to describe Mr. Levinson as a hostage, saying details of his case remain murky. They are concerned that the U.S., Britain, and Iran are stumbling into a new phase of tit-for-tat prisoner taking that was kicked off when the U.S. detained five Iranian officials in Iraq in January, sparking anger in Tehran. The U.S. State Department has revealed few details about Mr. Levinson's visit to Iran, insisting that he was there on purely private business. But Dawood Salahuddin, an American who converted to Islam and was given refuge in Iran in 1980, shed light on the mystery when he confirmed to the Financial Times in Tehran that he had met Mr. Levinson in a hotel on Kish on March 8th. Mr. Salahuddin, known in Iran as Hassan Abdulrahman, said he was detained by officials in plain clothes at 11 p.m. and taken from the room he shared with Mr. Levinson to be questioned about his Iranian passport. Mr. Salahuddin was freed the next afternoon and told by the officials that Mr. Levinson had flown back to Dubai. One of the things that we're going to do, although we haven't got time to go into it during the course of this broadcast, but in the description to the program, I'm going to set forth some material from the book Prelude to Terror about the aforementioned Dawood Salahuddin's links to Saeed Ramadan of the Muslim Brotherhood, who not only recruited Salahuddin to assassinate a former official of the Shah in Washington, D.C., which he did, he later recruited, that is to say, the CIA and Third Reich-connected Saeed Ramadan, helped to send Dawood Salahuddin, a.k.a. David Belfield, to fight the Soviets in the first Afghan war as well. For the Record Program 518, For the Record Program 343, among others, talking about the long-standing association between the Muslim Brotherhood and many institutions, including Fascist Italy, the Third Reich, the CIA, and the post-war Underground Reich, and post-World War II Italian fascism as well. Again, in the description for the broadcast, links between Salahuddin, Saeed Ramadan, and various activities, that from the book Prelude to Terror. Please get in the habit of utilizing the many, utilizing the Spitfire website and the many linked websites and functions. There's a tremendous amount of information available online. And those of you who only listen to the programs themselves are missing an awful lot of the For the Record experience. In particular, the network that we've been looking at in connection with September 11th is huge. It's a global network with many different facets: Italian fascism, international sports gambling, Islamism, and to some of the most powerful corporate and political figures around the world, including and especially in Washington, D.C., and the Bush administration. So in order to begin to make sense of this huge entity, in order to begin to really come to grips with the various elements of this network, please use the Spitfire website, use the audio files available from WFMU, and the Spitfire website itself. Use the printed sources, the descriptions, the books, and the databases that are such an important part at this point of the For the Record experience. At some point, we're going to take up the issue too, more of some of the organized Russian or an Eastern European organized crime links to this network. We haven't got time to go into that in this program, because this program is over, and this concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 596, update on September 11th and related matters. This has been recorded on May 6th of 2007. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.